My guest today, Professor Roberto Gonzalez, is a qualitative sociologist, associate professor at Harvard University, whose research has focused on the ways in which legal and educational institutions in this country shape the everyday experiences of poor minority immigrant youth as they move through life. He's recognized as one of the nation's leading experts on undocumented immigrant youth and young adults. Over the last decade, he has critically examined what happens to undocumented immigrant children as they move to adolescence and young adulthood, collecting in-depth data on over 300 undocumented young adults who have lived in the U.S. since childhood. And this has become the basis for his new book, Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America, about which we'll be speaking with him today. In addition to top social science journals, Professor Gonzalez's work has been featured in the New York Times, Washington Post, L.A. Times, Time, Wall Street Journal, U.S. News and World Report, The Chronicle of Higher Education, CNN, and NPR. It gives me great pleasure to add to the list and welcome Roberto Gonzalez to Takes on the World.
Thanks, Jeff, for having me. It's good to be here.
You've quite a remarkable book and quite a remarkable effort. Your Lives in Limbo and this morning's discussion comes at a very appropriate time following Donald Trump's dramatic victory in New Hampshire Republican primaries last night, one in which he was quick to emphasize his plan to build a massive wall along the border to keep Mexican immigrants out. And with some variations, hostility to Mexican immigration has been a recurring theme in the Republican debates, one shared to varying degrees by all the candidates. How do you see this affecting the subject you've been investigating this past decade, the plight of undocumented immigrants who live their lives in limbo?
Yeah, this is a really good question, especially as many people in the country look towards some immigration reform and the chances of that. And I think that as people are trying to surmise the chances of our country moving forward with some sort of comprehensive solution within the next few years. For the young people that I've been following for the last 12 years in this study, a lot of the campaign rhetoric and I think the inaction, ultimately inaction in Congress, continues to keep them at bay as they really must live their lives in limbo, not knowing what their future holds.
Well, they seem to be treated like a political football, and as Mexican immigrants have for my lifetime, and even in the Obama administration, we see the president has made outreach and specified certain worthy immigrants to be given not citizenship legalization. But the other hand, he has deported more people than any other president in history. How does this playing out in the Latino community?
Well, this is really tricky because, you know, here as candidate Obama, our president promised to address immigration very early in his presidency. During the campaign trail, he said that the Dream Act was something that they could take care of right away. But here we are left with upwards of 2.5 million deportations during his presidency. You know, I think that probably what has happened with our president is that, you know, I think that he extended the Bush policy Bush policy and philosophy around immigration, believing that if he showed that he was tough on the border, that if he was tough on enforcement, prove that he sealed the border, that ultimately then he could get some other more positive bills passed for immigrants, some more kind of policies focused at integration. But what we're left with at the end of his two terms really is a legacy that is more punctuated by enforcement and deportations than it is as being a champion of immigrants.
As I say, there's a history going back to the Bracero program. the domination of the United States of the Mexican economy, which most Americans are totally unaware of, has produced this kind of game in which Mexican immigrants, workers and non-workers are puppets, have lost their means of controlling their lives, and they're in this limbo. And you did so much work about some of these young undocumented immigrants who came in with their families. Some, you say, weren't even aware that they were illegal. I mean, that they didn't have papers because this wasn't told to them. They found it out later. Talk about the structure of this limbo in which they live.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. And I certainly appreciate the kind of broader kind of historical perspective that you provide, because I think that it's important for people to understand the context that undergird immigration to the United States today. And you know, certainly over the last several decades, Mexico has been the United States' top trade partner. We have a long-standing relationship with the country of Mexico and a long reliance on Mexican labor. Labor migration from Mexico to the United States is the longest and largest in the history of the world. Mexicans have been coming to the United States for generations to work in our fields. They helped to build our railroads. They worked on the coal mines. So there's a long legacy of Mexican migration to the United States. What has happened in the last few decades to alter what had been more or less predictable patterns of migration is that beginning in the late 1980s, the United States invested more money on our southern border, so started building longer, taller, and thicker fences, started putting more agents along the southern border, and invested billions of dollars in surveillance technology. As a result, it became a lot more difficult, a lot more costly, and a lot more dangerous to cross. So whereby in the 1970s, you had migrants come in the United States for periods of a few months at a time, leaving their families back home, and then making the trip back and forth. As it became a lot more difficult, a lot more costly, and a lot more dangerous to cross, we saw many Mexican migrants sending for their families. And so what you have in the late 1980s accelerating through the 90s is the growth of a large and settled population of Mexicans without legal immigration status that would make the United States their home. And as a result, a large pool of children who would grow up in the United States without access to legal status.
I should say I had some experience in this. Back in the early 70s, I lived in a small village in central Mexico, in the state of Guanajuato, called Chabacuaro, where two out of every 3 years, every able-bodied man in that village had to come to the United States and work illegally to maintain his ejido in Mexico. And we were busy, you had to work much harder in the fields of the United States than you did in your own country. But they had to do that. They were forced to do that. They were forced to grow in their own land in the village, food for American cattle. Otherwise, they couldn't get the money from the bank. They couldn't get the water. It was a controlled economy, which they had no say in. And so other than the fact they knew they had to go to the United States, and it's interesting, those who had papers, legal papers to work in the United States, they were totally divided from those who were illegal in the village. And I noticed you mentioned in some of the divisions caused within the United States between Mexicans, immigrants with more education and more, let's say, higher income, and those who are on the margins of society, how this is played against Mexicans on both sides of the border.
Yeah, this is a really good question. I think that certainly we have the United States has promoted these kind of what I call false binaries of kind of deserving versus undeserving, good immigrant versus bad immigrant for decades. And I think that these have been, if we look back historically at some of the debates around welfare, some of the debates around around immigration and around kind of belonging and membership, these debates about these kind of false binaries of kind of good and bad, deserving, undeserving, have been used by politicians to draw distinctions within communities, but don't reflect the reality of people's everyday experiences. Don't reflect the reality of the ways in which our policies and enforcement practices frame the lives of people in their everyday world.
Well, also talk about the criminalization of simply crossing the border. I mean, I heard of these yesterday private prisons, not government, private prisons run specifically for those who cross the border illegally. That it's like it's like a nightmare. It's in a sense of Guantanamo on American soil for people whose simple crime is being forced to seek a better living because of the economic conditions that have been forced upon them by American corporations, which is never part of the discussion in this country. But there's just a total lack of sympathy, empathy on the part of the larger American politic about this, and never kind of a recognition of our relationship with Mexico that has produced this. And of course, then you have the corporations who want cheap labor and the politicians who they give money to, and they're like playing a board game with the immigrants being the players, being the pawns in the game.
Yeah, well, these are people who pick our crops, work in kitchens of restaurants. These are people who take care of our dry cleaning. These are people who really kind of prop up our kind of service economy and our low wage labor market. Their presence, I think that the this is a classic example of the ways in which this country has historically relied on the labor of migrants, and particularly migrants from Mexico, but feels very differently about their presence in communities across the country. And as you mentioned, the kind of criminalization of workers makes life very difficult for them. These private detention centers that you mentioned, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and our USCIS has quotas of those detained. Those who are in the number of people in beds per day. Whereas we rely on the labor, the cheap, pliant, flexible labor of migrants, to do the work that most Americans don't want to do, and to allow most Americans comfortable lifestyle, not paying high prices for produce and for other services. There's this really kind of dark history around how we have dealt with immigration and migrants more specifically.
Now in California, of course, which was part of the great land theft took place during the Mexican War, which interesting historical anecdote Bobby Kennedy was traveling in 1960s in Indonesia and bragging about how America had never started a war. And they reminded him, these students in Indonesia who knew more about American history than American students here knew, about the invasion of Mexico. And early, and they didn't, they don't learn here that Abraham Lincoln resigned from Congress in protest against that war. They don't learn what Ulysses Grant said about it. They may learn that Thoreau went to jail to protest, but that's the greatest land theft in history. And yet Americans have never really recognized it as being anything other than legitimization of our manifest destiny. And I think this guides, controls the thinking about Mexico and Mexican immigrants without a question in my mind. What was your observation on that?
Yeah, I think that that's right, and I think that, this has had chilling effects in Mexican communities throughout the country, and it's certainly affected the ways in which young people come to think of the United States as their home, come to think about their belonging in communities and across the country. When I started the study for this book, I set out to understand more fully the ways in which our policies shaped, maybe more appropriately framed, the lives of immigrants. And I what I came to find was a real kind of puzzling story about the ways in which young immigrants are integrated into this country, but then ultimately cast out.
How easy was that for you when you were to approach them? I mean, you did a very thorough study, and of course, many obviously would be hesitant to talk to an investigator, even a Mexican American, because of just paranoia, which the whole culture produces.
Yeah, this is an important question, and this was this is something that I thought a lot about as I started this work. Prior to graduate school, I had spent 10 years as a youth worker and a youth organizer in Chicago, and I lived and worked in the same neighborhood for a decade, largely immigrant community. Mostly Mexican, and living and working alongside of the families in this community, I got to know the circumstances of a lot of kids and a lot of their families, and so having youth programs for kids, we started noticing over the years that for many of our kids that had come to the United States at very early ages with their families, that they were running into dead ends. They're at around 15, 16, 17 years old, as their friends were thinking about getting driver's licenses, summer jobs, after school work, registering to vote, registering for selective service, applying to college, getting financial aid for college. As their friends moved forward, they had no choice but to stand on the sidelines as their friends passed them by. We had many of those young people became very frustrated, very disillusioned, and ultimately left school. A smaller portion of them had gone all the way to their senior year in high school, were wanting to go to college, but there weren't opportunities. There was not in-state tuition for them at the time. They're excluded from federal financial aid, and so they had very few options, and very few people in the community really knew what to do with them or what to do for them. We're not empowered in terms of trying to help them. Fast forward a few years, and I'm in a graduate program in California, in Southern California, and I start meeting, through volunteer work, a lot of young people who had very similar stories, had come to the U.S. at 6 months old, 2 years old, 5 years old, had grown up side by side with American-born peers and friends, had grown up to the daily Pledge of Allegiance at their school, to Barney and the Power Rangers, to Disneyland and Los Angeles Dodgers, had gone to prom, had dated their citizen and American-born peers, but again at that critical time, life was turned upside down for them. So I really wanted to understand, what was happening in their lives to turn them upside down in such a fashion. And so my years of as a youth worker really paid dividends. I understood from working with youth that it was not advisable to start asking sensitive questions before really knowing them, before really really establishing relationships and establishing rapport. And so that's what I did. And for many of the people in my study, most of them I knew for more than a year before I started asking intrusive questions. But rather, I wanted to do what I could to give back more than I was asking. So I tutored in after-school programs. I showed up early to meetings and stayed late, setting up chairs, helping people take down. I did what I could to be a consistent presence within communities so that people could see that I was not a kind of fly-by-night researcher who was just going to swoop down and get what I needed and then leave, but rather I had, I had a stake in this discussion, and I had a real kind of earnest desire to really learn from their circumstances.
How has their response been to the book? Those of you you've shown it to. By the way, I should say, I remind you, I'm speaking with Professor Roberto Gonzalez about his book, Lives in Limbo, Undocumented Coming of Age and Coming of Age in America, which is published by University of California Press just the end of, beginning of this year. It's just out. Have you had responses from any of those you spoke with?
Yeah, I've had, I've heard from several. I've stayed in touch. I should say for the listening audience that the study that the book is based on, it spans from, I began in late 2012 and ended in 2015. And so I've been able to follow 150 young people over these 12 years. And many of them now have read the book, and the response has been overwhelmingly positive. I think that many people many of my respondents are grateful. I think that they appreciate that the book has come out during this election cycle, and that the book is contributing to a kind of broader national conversation about immigration, and doing so from the perspective as a qualitative researcher that I was able to obtain, and that is a very close-up, in-depth examination of the details of their lives over a long stretch of time.
I noticed there was an article in the New York Times the other day how a number of young Mexican-Americans who are undocumented, even though they're not able to vote, have become involved in working in this 2016 election, which might have some very interesting outcomes. There has not been, as I recall, the Democratic debate, much discussion about immigration.
This has been a little puzzling to me.
Yes, go on.
Yeah, I think that, while, certainly there's been a lot of attention on the Republican side when, Donald Trump, when he announced his candidacy last spring, he really launched his campaign on a immigration restrictionist platform, a really kind of red anti-immigrant, anti-Mexican. But there's been really little of substance coming from the candidates regarding specific policy details. you know, I think that on the Republican side, Jeb Bush he's waffled on immigration. He's also publicly stated that he didn't think that anchor babies was a derogatory term. Marco Rubio has walked back many of his previous statements on immigration. He's also argued against some of his previous positions. It looks like on the Republican side, John Kasich has come across as the most supportive of Republican candidates. He has said that it's not realistic to send 11 million immigrants back to their countries of origin. He's advocating for keeping families together. He favors a guest worker program, and seems like the most kind of sensible on this issue. But turning to the Democrats, certainly Hillary Clinton has a mixed record on immigration. As a senator, she went back and forth on the driver's license issue. She has recently supported the Obama administration's efforts to deport unaccompanied minor children. But she also has progressive views on ending detention and supporting a pathway to legalization. I think similar, Bernie Sanders, while many people initially believe that immigration was a blind spot for him, he has hired a couple high-profile undocumented immigrant youth or dreamers to key positions in his campaign. And he's now advocating for a pathway to legalization for all undocumented immigrants. But I think beyond some of these kind of more general positions that these candidates have taken, there's just been very little of substance around immigration.
Yeah, I had a feeling that there are certain questions that the candidates and the interviewers agree will not be asked. Because it seems so obvious, for example, no one's asked the Republican candidates about the occupation in Oregon of this of American land. I mean, it should have been a subject, but it hasn't been. Interesting, you write about Bill Clinton and the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 and the impact that had on Mexican immigration, Mexicans in the country.
Yeah, the 1996 laws have made they did a couple of things, but they really resulted in an expansion of the definition of aggravated felony in this country, and as a result I think the kind of multiplication of immigrants who fall into the criminal justice system, really criminalizing criminalizing immigrant communities and making it very difficult for immigrants. 96 laws, I think, also gave birth to what became 287G agreements, and they also have resulted in a shrinking of rights for non-citizens. And so what we've seen over the last 2 to 3 decades is that that immigrants are faced with kind of escalating enforcement, criminalizing their presence, while they've also contended with a real shrinking of rights. And that has served, and those two things in tandem have served to really narrowly circumscribe immigrants' everyday worlds.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's puzzled me. I keep hearing on the radio how Hillary and the Clintons have so much support within the Latino and African American communities, and I'm unable to really determine a rational reason for that. And she's going into Nevada, where there are many Mexican American commercial workers, food and culinary workers, and hotel workers, and that's supposed to be Clinton land, but I'm kind of mystified by that. Maybe she'll be surprised there as well.
Yeah, Hillary has done has had traditionally broad support from the unions, but I think Nevada will be a real test for her campaign, and I think that will be I think that we'll have a lot more answers as to how unions, but more specifically to this conversation, how Latinos and how immigrants are responding to her record and her potential as a candidate.
I want to actually get, before we, in the time we have left, to the situation in California, which at one time was really terrible, particularly under Pete Wilson, and how the changes have taken place that seem to be more positive. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, it looks like, it looks like from the on the face of things that California has really provided a model in immigrant integration for the rest of the country. Over the last several years, particularly during Governor Jerry Brown's tenure, California has passed bills allowing undocumented immigrant students to compete for state financial aid. California has passed a driver's license bill to allow undocumented immigrants to apply for driver's licenses in the state. It has lifted exclusions to practicing a profession that requires a professional license. So California has taken major steps towards immigrant integration in the absence of a federal solution. You know, we can look at states like Arizona and other states, Alabama, South Carolina, that have taken the opposite approach, have been much more punitive in immigration policy. But certainly today, in this contemporary period, as we think about the elections and as we talk about immigration, where one lives matters a great deal to the kinds of access one might enjoy.
Well, it seemed, you mentioned the unions. One of the problems that I've encountered with the unions over the years is that they're more wedded to their connections to the Democratic Party than they are to the benefits for their membership. So this may be one of these situations in which that causes some changes in the way their members vote. There's been a long time dispute because the unions will give money to their favorite candidates without consulting their membership, and this is generally not a problem, although Republicans have complained about it. But it might become a problem this year. How big is this generation? You refer to as the 1.5 generation. How big is this in general?
Yeah, so we typically look at kind of this number of 11 to 12 million people living in the United States with undocumented status. We typically look at them as a kind of group of 11 million undocumented workers, but the reality is that more than 2 million of them have lived in the United States since childhood. So we've got 2 to 2.5 million undocumented immigrants who've been here since their early ages. As I mentioned before, some of them coming as early as 6 months old, 2 years old, five years old. Many of them have grown up in communities across this country. They've been schooled in neighborhoods across the country. But, our laws treat children and adults differently, but don't account for the continuity of these kids becoming adults. And so as many of these young people look at the debates today, look at this election cycle, and look at their futures, there's still a lot of uncertainty around what's going to happen with their lives. Is Congress going to finally act? But until then, they have no choice but to wait.
Or become involved, because this election for them, even though it's not openly discussed, they have a lot on the line. Because if we have, I mean, I'm a registered Green, but we have a Trump or a Ted Cruz, or even a Rubio, who gets in, their lives are going to be much more in jeopardy.
Yeah, and I think that your point is a really important one. That certainly, since probably about 2007, that these young people have organized collectively across the country to be one of the most impressive social movements of our time. And I think that certainly while their futures are very uncertain, we see a lot of them who are really out there pushing this conversation and pushing for progressive reform.
Well, Roberto Gonzalez, we've come to the end of a very interesting hour. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Your book, Lives in Limbo, Undocumented in America, check one of our local bookstores. If they don't have it, order it. It's a very important book. This is a part of an important part of the community and education that we need to know. So thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye, studios. The time is now 10 o'clock. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.